WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Brighton Breitenbach is a South African poet, painter, and former political prisoner, now living in exile in Paris. He's generally acknowledged as the leading poet writing in Afrikaans, the language associated with white rule. As Lawrence Weschler wrote in The New Yorker, no one elevated the language to such pure beauty, and no one wielded it so devastatingly against the apartheid regime. Breitenbach left his country for Paris in 1960. In exile, he co-founded an anti-apartheid organization. In 1975, that group sent him undercover to South Africa with a forged passport. But the police were on to him. He was imprisoned under the Terrorism Act and served 7 years of a 9-year sentence before he was allowed to return to Paris in 1982. He's just completed his third memoir. His new book, Return to Paradise, is about his 3-month visit to South Africa in 1991 after the African National Congress, which he had been associated with, was unbanned. I asked him if he thought it was possible to fit back into life in South Africa.
Having lived for so long in France, or lived in Europe, or having moved in other parts of Africa, it became a way of life, which I was then reluctant to give up. It has a certain freedom, this rootlessness. And I'd grown maybe not deep roots, but alternative bypassing roots during all those years. I couldn't pretend now that these didn't exist. And then I found that if I were to go back then, perhaps even now, I would inevitably become very heavily involved in what was happening in the country, and that would be very time-consuming and would perhaps also even be very frustrating and tiring and enervating, because I think that, as with so many other countries going through a like situation, there are a lot of arguments, conditions nearly, that have to be gone through before people can come to an even keel again and continue with their lives.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to your early history. You dropped out of college in South Africa to leave your country. Mm-hmm. You ended up in Paris, where you were, mm-hmm, you know, living as an exile. Why did you want to leave South Africa?
I wanted, on the one hand, I studied painting, and I wanted to get to where I thought the heartland of painting was. That was Paris. I was close to friends a little bit older than I, who had just returned from Paris after a long stay. I was very impressed and envious of what they'd gone through. And of course, like everybody else living far away from Europe, I was following through art publication that was happening. I thought that's where it was, and that's where I wanted to go. But also, I was at the University of Cape Town, which was one of the few so-called liberal universities that were still to some extent integrated. In other words, I had a certain number of so-called black or colored or Indian students, and I found myself in class with them, and we socialized, we became friends. I got to understand them a little bit. And I certainly identified with a lot of their problems, and in any event, the university as such was then involved in resisting a law that was segregating university, but to take away all the so-called non-white students. And we manifested against that. I got into troubles because of it, like many other people did. I had been called in by the police twice. I had been warned that I was going to get my fingers burnt. I certainly also knew a certain number of people who were already involved in political activity of a heavier kind underground, so-called African resistance movement. The place was quite hot, Cape Town. It was boiling. Many things were in the air. So there was certainly that, although it's not anything as structured or as deeply committed as it became later on. And I can't say I left because I was forced out for political reasons, but I certainly was very aware that I was starting to move into an area that was becoming dangerous.
In Paris, you co-founded an anti-apartheid group, and it was decided that you would go on behalf of this group to South Africa, mm-hmm, on a mission undercover with a fake passport and a fake name.
Yes.
And it was on that trip that you were arrested and then imprisoned for, mm-hmm, about 7 years. Mm-hmm. you were pretty well known. I mean, you were pretty well known as a writer already in South Africa. Do you think it was a bad choice to choose you to be the person going undercover?
Yeah, it's a little bit, but it's also, you know, had I gone and come out again, everybody would have thought it would have been a perfectly normal thing to do. It's a little bit of second guessing. We had sent in many people, not many, we'd sent in quite a few into the country before, and we'd been lucky. We thought we'd worked out the logistics of how to do it. We also had brought out quite a fair number of people and would spend time with us abroad, and we'd given training, and then they'd return to the country. So this was not exactly breaking new ground. And we were fairly, despite, you know, what is now being said, we did go to quite some lengths to disguise our movements and ourselves, etc. I'm not so very sure that it was the fact of me going back that made my arrest inevitable, whether it wouldn't have happened anyway, whether it was and somebody else going in under that name. I think it was rather a case of what we were doing then coming to a point where it would become really significant and perhaps significantly dangerous, on the one hand to the state that we were combating, on the other hand perhaps to allies whom we were working with, who didn't want perhaps to see rivals doing things that they thought they ought to be doing.
Do you think you were set up?
I think I must have been. I'm not sure whether I was set up. I think I was definitely sold out. Set up? No. I took a very strong personal part in making the decision to go. Nobody forced me to do so. So it couldn't be that. The setup part may come to the extent that somebody knowing beforehand where I was going to be or when I was going to be in the country may have passed on the information.
So you think that somebody did sell you out, that someone passed on the information that you were there undercover, making it easy for the authorities to find you?
I think so. Well, you know, it's a murky world, that world. It was double dealing and double guessing and all the rest of it. I've given up a long time ago trying to find out who or what had caused the arrest, because it's not the kind of information that anybody, even if it were in his possession, would let me have without wanting to exploit it or to manipulate me through it.
When you were imprisoned, you pled guilty to charges of terrorism and apologized for the, quote, ridiculous and stupid things that you had done. Why did you decide to plead guilty?
Oh, I pleaded guilty because I had a choice of either pleading guilty to that particular charge sheet or being convicted of a very much heavier charge sheet, which included things like nuclear spying, smuggling people and arms across the border, acts of armed sabotage, all of which the state would have made stick, although none of it were true. We are talking of a totalitarian state. We're talking of a state that decides what it wants to find you guilty of. And what you yourself have done or not done is totally insignificant. It makes no difference. I was, in short, given a choice of being convicted to be executed or to be convicted for lesser crimes with carrying a minimum sentence of 5 years. And with, on my side, the implicit promise that I will not make a political trial after trial, which is what they wanted to avoid at all costs. Not that I necessarily understood all the reasons why it was so important for them to avoid it. And on their side, the promise that they would release all the other people that had been arrested with me or after my arrest. And this indeed did happen. Not a single one of them. I mean, they were arrested and detained, but not a single one of them were taken to court or sentenced for anything. As for apologizing, well, you know, I think one has to go back and read it clearly within its context. It's not quite the way it comes across now. I don't think I've ever at any point denied my convictions. And if I apologize for certain stupid things, well, they were so patently stupid. The very fact that I'm standing in court was a proof of patent stupidity. The apology was not necessarily directed at the state.
So did you compose your statement in such a way so that you would be able to say it and know in your heart of hearts what you were admitting to and what you weren't?
Yes, to some extent. First of all, you know, it's not something one can talk about to people who haven't been through anything similar. I suppose you'd have to go and find, one would have to go and find somebody from the Soviet Union or from the time of the Slansky trials in Czechoslovakia or in modern day other countries where this kind of thing may still happen, still be going on, to have any beginning of an understanding of what the relationship between a detainee being interrogated and his interrogator may be. There's a fair and a very thorough amount of brainwashing going on, obviously. I have no qualms about what I did there then. I'm not sure that I wouldn't be doing exactly the same under other circumstances. I, in fact, have no patience whatsoever with, you know, as we say in Afrikaans, with those standing on the shore giving very good advice to him or her who was drowning. I didn't certainly intend to go and let myself be strung from a gallows just to satisfy vicariously the need for moral satisfaction by a lot of do-gooders abroad. And as for the commitment to the struggle, as for the commitment to my convictions, these have never changed. I don't think I dented them in any way. I don't think I fooled anybody who really knew me. I unfortunately doesn't even see me if I particularly fooled those whom I tried to fool to some extent, that is the state or the interrogators facing me. And I continued in some form by other means to fight the same battle.
So there was kind of a bargain that if you handled yourself a certain way, that the government would give you a lighter sentence and release other people who were involved. Do you feel that they completely held up their end of the bargain?
No, of course not. But neither did I. You know, it was a fool's deal to start with. So I suppose I can't blame them too badly for that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is exiled South African writer Brighton Breitenbach. He's written a new memoir about his 1991 return to South Africa. It's called Return to Paradise. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is exiled South African writer Brighton Breitenbach. Something else, and I'm not asking this to pass judgment, but I just am curious about it. While you were in jail, you wrote to the head of the security police offering to inform in exchange for a quicker release.
I should imagine that the very fact that they produced this during trial was a clear indication of their seeing right through that particular attempt. If they had the slightest feel, the slightest hope that I was serious in presenting something like this, they would never have made this public. And so they did the second best, smear me with it. No, I have no problems with that either. I can say with total satisfaction that I've never betrayed anybody, and which is quite contrary from a fair number of people whom I know, some of whom are sitting in the very highest councils of the ANC at the moment.
What would you have done if the police said, okay, you've got a deal?
I would have gone out and I would have immediately denounced the deal the moment I would have been in safety anywhere out of their reach.
Doesn't it work the other way around, though, that you have to name names first and then they deliver you to safety?
Well, probably that's why I never got out. Maybe, I mean, even they knew that I wasn't willing to do. They never asked me for that, and I suppose so. We never even got to that step. No, I don't think it would have worked that way. No, in any case, we never got to. We wouldn't have. There wasn't any chance of getting that far. No, I don't think so. You know, after all, while this was going on, if you want to take the trouble, you can go and do some research, some other letters, some of which were intercepted and were reproduced at various points. I smuggled out of prison saying exactly what was going on and giving exact information as to who was in danger outside and who I thought may be a danger to people and what they should look out for. So they probably knew this also. It was not quite as easy as it sounds. I think people live in a kind of a make-believe world. What they retain from all these experiences, or what seemed to excite them endlessly, would be these little things that you're talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of statement in court. I don't know. It must be some kind of picking of the nose, I should imagine. But it doesn't particularly strike me as being something that is of much interest.
I hope you don't misinterpret my questions. I'm not trying to ask you to pass judgment. It's just that so many of the people who I've interviewed have been political prisoners talk about things about how you can't admit to anything, and you can never cut a deal because they'll, you know, with the authorities, because they'll turn on you anyways. I find it really interesting that you took a different course when you were in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there are other people who have done that but haven't talked about it. Do you know what I mean? So it's just very interesting for me to hear
mm-hmm.
why you did what you did, which is different from what most other political prisoners have discussed with us on the program.
Maybe.
So
I don't know.
I'm not asking you to try to pass judgment, but rather to...
Oh, I don't pass judgment on anything. I mean, I don't... In fact, I couldn't care a damn for judgments that other people pass. But really, I could not care one moment about what... the kind of life I have led, or perhaps even to some extent been born into... I've known from very young on it's going to make me fairly unacceptable to a very large number of people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm terminally politically incorrect. So it doesn't bother me at all. It doesn't. It's no skin off my nose. And whatever judgment anybody may make, you or anybody else, is not going to make any difference to what I feel or what I continue doing. As for what other political prisoners may or may not have gone through, I think the only people whom I would perhaps, it may sound very arrogant, deign to really talk to about these matters would be other political prisoners. And I can assure you we talk about it in quite a different way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm sure. Your father, when you were in prison, wrote a letter to Prime Minister Voerster
mm-hmm.
asking for leniency on your behalf. And Voerster
mm-hmm.
wrote that it was an old phenomenon in Afrikaner families for one son to be a traitor
mm-hmm.
and one to be a hero. And I know that your older brother
mm-hmm.
was, I believe, like the most decorated member of the South African Defense Force, a founder
mm-hmm.
of the Defense Force's Special Forces Unit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a great upholder of, mm-hmm. of the apartheid system. Does it seem typical to you to have that in Afrikaner families in the way that Voerster said it is, you know?
Well, you had a civil war too, didn't you?
I'm sorry?
You had a civil war too, didn't you?
Yes, yes, yes.
And you must have had times, even during the Vietnam War, when people in the same family went diametrically opposite directions.
Absolutely.
No, I don't think this is so... Well, if I may be a little bit cynical about it, it's the kind of thing that can only happen in an Afrikaner family because the English-speaking families, white families, don't necessarily ever become involved enough in the situation in the country to have to make a decision either way. They are riding nicely whichever way the dice fall. But it is true that to the extent that the Afrikaners are... rooted, whether they like it or not, in that part of the world, and to the extent that they have nowhere else to go, and to the extent that they tend to perhaps involve themselves in whatever they believe in fairly radically, that this kind of a rift will appear from time to time. It happens in quite a lot of families.
Do you think your parents thought of you as a traitor?
I should never think so, no. Certainly not. Certainly not. No, you know, it's a different thing when you are there, when you're on the ground. It doesn't work that way. I think we tend to romanticize these things so terribly that we end up with totally false impressions. Do you think in the hearts of hearts that the parent would ever consider his or her child a traitor? I can't imagine that.
In the introduction to your book, you refer to what you think is a new politically correct orthodoxy in South Africa. You've said before that you're kind of hopelessly politically incorrect. What's the new politically correct orthodoxy that you're referring to?
People's power, let's put it that way. It's perhaps taking a bit of a shortcut, although I also very strongly believe in people's power, but I think I understand something quite different from it. The idea of vanguardism, the idea that you will have an elite of people who know what the answers are and who will bit by bit feed the necessary information, perhaps to the masses as they grow into adulthood enough to understand and to be manipulated properly. The new political correctness would be, for the time being, I think, a rejection of anything that may be labeled as reflecting a set of norms or standards which are considered to be elitist or exclusive. It would be the kind of thing, for instance, that would put heavy demands on people to be writing social realist works and not to go off into abscons and obscure sideways and byways like somebody like, for instance, J.M. Coetzee might do. There's an attempt, I think, to rewrite history, to reinterpret history. There is perhaps also an effort to pretend that some of the things we saw horribly go wrong elsewhere didn't really happen and will certainly not happen here, so that we are gearing ourselves for making the same mistakes. There are many of these things, particularly a certain intolerance of difference, a certain intolerance of dissidents particularly, which, by the way, I think is going to create a whole new generation of dissidents.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure indeed.
Brighton Breitenbach's new memoir is called Return to Paradise. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.